Please be advised that the opinions and views expressed by Richard Martin of GF Investment Services, LLC are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent the views of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments based off of Richard Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener and the investor.
Good morning there, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to Memorial Day, the 28th of May, hopefully. This is a recorded show, and I prevailed upon our long-suffering Matt to do this for me, and I'm very grateful to him for the possibility of bringing you a show on Memorial Day, not live, but specially designed for Memorial Day listeners. And I would say that I am not expecting, of course, any calls from anybody, and I will perhaps read some emails towards the end of the show if I have time. But as I mentioned to you on Friday, it is my intention to bring to you today a talk by Jim Grant, who is a very well-known financial commentator, and is the head of the Grants Interest Rate Observer. And basically, he gave a talk to the Federal Reserve Board, or rather some selected members of it, a few weeks ago. And it is so pithy and so incisive that, and I must tell you, I don't normally do this, but I felt that it was worth your attention and worth bringing it to you in its entirety, simply because it really goes to show the impotence and the absolute inutility of the Federal Reserve and how it has grown up into this absurd monster which has no real economic interest in its very existence. And I think it's very brave of Jim Grant to dare to talk in the terms that he talks during this incredible lecture that he gives to these people. I understand that there was some doubt as to whether the lecture would actually go ahead when they discovered exactly who had been invited. I understand they tried to uninvite him, but the process was too far gone, so without further ado, let me bring you Jim Grant's piece called A Piece of My Mind, and it goes as follows. My friends and neighbors, I thank you for this opportunity. You know we are friends and neighbors. Grant's makes its offices on Wall Street, overlooking Broadway, a 10-minute stroll from your imposing headquarters. For a spectacular vantage point on the next ticker tape parade up Broadway, please drop by. We'll have the windows washed. You say you would like to hear my complaints, and on the one hand I do have a few, while on the other I can't help but feel slightly hypocritical in dressing you down. What passes for sound doctrine in 21st century central banking, so-called financial repression, interest rate manipulation, stock price levitation, and money printing under the frosted glass term quantitative easing, presents us at Grants with a nearly endless supply of good copy. Our symbiotic relationship with the Fed resembles that of Fox News with the Obama administration, or, in an earlier era, that of the Chicago Tribune with the Purple Gang. Grants needs the Fed, even if the Fed doesn't need Grants. In the not quite 100 years since the founding of your institution, America has exchanged central banking for a kind of central planning and the gold standard for what I will call the PhD standard. I regret the changes and will propose reforms, or I suppose re-reforms, as my program is very much in accord with that of the founders of this institution. Have you ever read the Federal Reserve Act? The authorizing legislation projected a body, quote, to provide for the establishment of the Federal Reserve banks to furnish an elastic currency, to afford means of rediscounting commercial paper, and to establish a more effective supervision of banking in the United States and for other purposes, end of quote. By now, we can identify the operative phrase, of course, for other purposes. You are lucky, if I may say so, that I'm the one who's standing here and not the ghost of Senator Carter Glass. One hesitates to speak for the dead, but I am reasonably sure that the Virginia Democrat, who regarded himself as the father of the Fed, would skewer you. He had an abhorrence of paper money and government debt. He didn't like Wall Street either. And I'm going to guess that he wouldn't much care for the Fed raising up stock prices under the theory of the portfolio balance channel. It inflamed him that during congressional debate over the Federal Reserve Act, Elihu Root, Republican senator from New York, impugned the anticipated Federal Reserve notes as fiat currency. Fiat, indeed, Glass snorted. The nation was on the gold standard. It would remain on the gold standard, Glass had no reason to doubt. The projected notes of the Federal Reserve would, of course, be convertible into gold on demand at the fixed statutory rate of $20.67 per ounce. But more stood behind the notes than gold. They would be collateralized as well by sound commercial assets, by the issuing member bank and, a point to which I will return, by the so-called double liability of the issuing bank's stockholders. If Glass had the stronger argument, Root had the clearer vision. One can think of the original Federal Reserve note as a kind of derivative. It derived its value chiefly from gold, into which it was lawfully exchangeable. Now that the Federal Reserve note is exchangeable into nothing except small change, it is a derivative without an underlier. Or, at a stretch, one might say it is a derivative that secures its value from the wisdom of Congress and the foresight and judgment of the monetary scholars at the Federal Reserve. Either way, we would seem to be in dangerous, uncharted waters. As you prepare to mark the Fed centenary, may I urge you to reflect on just how far you have wandered from the intentions of the founders. The institution they envisioned would operate passively through the discount window. It would not create credit, but rather liquefy the existing stock of credit by turning good quality commercial bills into cash, temporarily. This it would do according to the demands of the seasons and the cycle. The Fed would respond to the community, not try to anticipate or lead it. It would not override the price mechanism, as today's Fed seems to do at every available opportunity, but yield to it. My favorite exposition of the sound original doctrines is a book entitled The Theory and Practice of Central Banking by H. Parker Willis, First Secretary of the Federal Reserve Board and Glass's right-hand man in the House of Representatives. Writing in the mid-30s, Willis pointed out that the Fed fell into sin almost immediately after it opened for business in 1914. In 1917, after the United States entered the Great War, the Fed set about monetizing the Treasury's debt and suppressing the Treasury's borrowing costs. In the 1920s, after the recovery from the short but ugly depression of 1920-21, the Fed started to implement open market operations to sterilize gold flows and steer a desired macroeconomic course. Central banks, wrote Willis, glaring at the innovators, will do wisely to lay aside their inexpert ventures in half-baked monetary theory, meretricious statistical measures of trade, and hastily grinding of the axes of speculative interests with the suggestion that by doing so they are achieving some sort of vague stabilization that will, in the long run, be for the greater good. Willis, who died in 1937, perhaps of a broken heart, would be no happier today with you today than Glass would be, or I am. The search for some sort of vague stabilization in the 1930s has become a Federal Reserve obsession at the millennium. Ladies and gentlemen, such stability as might be imposed on a dynamic capitalist economy is the kind that eventually comes around to bite the stabilizer. So-called price stability is a case in point. It is your mandate, or half your mandate, I realize, but it does grievous harm as defined. For reasons you never exactly spell out, you pledge to resist deflation. You won't put up with it, you keep on saying. Something about Japan's lost decade or the Great Depression. But you never say what deflation really is. Let me attempt a definition. Deflation is a derangement of debt, a symptom of which is falling prices. In a credit crisis, when inventories become unfinanceable, merchandise is thrown on the market and prices fall. That's deflation. What deflation is not is a drop in prices caused by a technology-enhanced decline in the costs of production. That's called progress. Between 1875 and 1896, according to Milton Friedman and Anna Schwartz, the American price level subsided at the average rate of 1.7% a year. And why not? As technology was advancing, costs were tumbling. Long before Joseph Schumpeter coined the phrase creative destruction, the American economist David A. Wells, writing in 1889, was explaining the consequences of disruptive innovation. In the last analysis, Wells proposes, it will appear that there is no such thing as fixed capital. There is nothing useful that is very old except the precious metals, and life consists in the conversion of forces. The only capital which is of permanent value is immaterial, the experience of generations, and the development of science. End of quote. Much the same sentiments and much the same circumstances apply today, but with a difference. Digital technology and a globalized labor force have brought down production costs. But the central bankers declare prices must not fall. On the contrary, they must rise by 2% a year. To engineer this upcreep, the Bernankes, the Kings, the Draghis, and yes, sadly, even the Dudleys of the world monetize assets and push down interest rates. They do this to conquer deflation. But note, please, that the suppression of interest rates and the conjuring of liquidity set in motion waves of speculative lending and borrowing. This artificially induced activity serves to lift the prices of a favored class of asset, houses, for instance, or Mitt Romney's portfolio of leveraged companies. And when the central bank-financed bubble bursts, credit contracts, leveraged businesses teeter, inventories are liquidated, and prices weaken. In short, a process is set in motion resembling a real deflation, which then calls forth a new bout of monetary intervention. By trying to forestall an imagined deflation, the Federal Reserve comes perilously close to instigating the real thing. The economist Hyman Minsky laid down the paradox that stability is itself destabilizing. I say that the pledge of a stable funds rate through the fourth quarter of 2014 is hugely destabilizing. Interest rates are prices. They convey information, or ought to. But the only information conveyed in a manipulated yield curve is what the Fed wants. Opportunists don't have to be told twice how to respond. They buy oil or gold or foreign exchange, not incidentally pushing the price of a gallon of gasoline at the pump to $4 and beyond. Another set of opportunists borrow short and lend long in the credit markets, not especially caring about the risk of inflation over the long run. This speculative cohort will fund mortgages, junk bonds, treasuries, what have you, at 0% in the short run. The opportunists, also known as the 1%, will do fine. But what about the uncomprehending others? I commend to the Federal Reserve Bank of New York Financial History Book Club, if it doesn't exist, please organize it at once, a volume by the British scholar and central banker Charles Goodhart. Its title is The New York Money Market and the Finance of Trade, 1900 to 1913. In the pre-Fed days with which the history deals, the call money rate dived and soared. There was no stability, and a good thing, Goodhart reasons. In a society predisposed to speculate, as America was and is, he writes, unpredictable spikes in borrowing rates kept the players more or less honest. On the basis of its record, he writes of the second Federal Reserve District before there was a Federal Reserve, the financial system as constituted in the years 1900 to 1913 must be considered successful to an extent rarely equaled in the United States. End of quote. And that notwithstanding the panic of 1907. My reading of history accords with Goodhart's, though not with that of the Fed's front office. If Chairman Bernanke were in the room, I would respectfully ask him why this persistent harking back to the Great Depression. It is one cyclical episode, but there are many others. I myself draw more instruction from the Depression of 1920 to 21, a slump as ugly and steep in its way as that of 1929 to 23. But with the simple and interesting difference that it ended. Top to bottom, spring 1920 to summer 1921, nominal GDP fell by 23.9%, wholesale prices by 40.8%, and the CPI by 8.3%. Unemployment, as it was inexactly measured, topped out at about 14% from a pre-bust low of as little as 2%. And how did the administration of Warren G. Harding meet this macroeconomic calamity? Why, it balanced the budget, the president declaring in 1921, as the economy seemed to be falling apart, quote, "There is not a menace in the world today like that of growing public indebtedness and mounting public expenditures." End of quote. And the fledgling Fed, face to face with its first big slump, what did it do? Why, it tightened, pushing up short rates in mid-depression to as high as 8.13% from a business cycle peak of 6%. It was the one and only time in the history of this institution that money rates at the trough of a cycle were higher than rates at the peak, according to Alan Meltzer. But then, something wonderful happened. markets cleared, and a vibrant recovery began. There were plenty of bankruptcies and no few brickbats launched in the direction of the governor of the New York Fed, Benjamin Strong. For the deflation that cut an especially wide and devastating swath through the American farm economy. But in 1922, the first full year of recovery, the Fed's index of industrial production leapt by 27.3%. By 1923, the unemployment rate was back to 3.2%. The 1920s began to roar. And do you know that the biggest nationally chartered bank to fail during this deflationary collapse was the First National Bank of Cleburne, Texas, with not quite $2.8 million of deposits? Even the forerunner to today's Citigroup remained solvent, though for Citi, even then, it was a close-run thing on account of its oversized exposure to deflating Cuban sugar values. No TARP. No starving the savers with 0% interest rates, no QE, no jimmying up the stock market, no federal stimulus of any kind. Yet, I repeat, the Depression ended. To those today who demand even more intervention to cure what ails us, I ask, why did the Depression of 1920 to 21 ever end? Given the policies with which the authorities treated it, why are we still not ensnared? If you object to using the template of 1920 to 21 as a guide to 21st century policy because, well, 1920 was a long time ago, I reply that 1929 was a long time ago, too. And if you persist in objecting, because the lessons to be derived from the Harding Depression are unthinkably at odds with the lessons so familiarly mined from the Hoover and Roosevelt Depression, I reply that Harding's approach worked. The price mechanism is truer, an enterprise hardier than the promoters of radical 21st century intervention seem prepared to acknowledge. In notable contrast to the Harding method, today's policies seem not to be working. We legislate and regulate and intervene, but still the patient languishes. It's a worldwide failure of the institutions of money and credit. I see in the papers that Banca Monte dei Paschi di Siena is in the toils of a debt crisis. For the first time in over 500 years, the foundation that controls this ancient Italian institution may be forced to sell shares. We've all heard of 100-year floods. We seem to be in a kind of 500-year debt flood. Many now call for more regulation, more such institutions as the Treasury's brand new Office of Financial Research, for instance. In the March 8 Financial Times, the columnist Gillian Tett appealed for more resources for the overwhelmed regulators. Inundated with information, she lamented, they can't keep up with the institutions they are supposed to be safeguarding. To me, the trouble is not that the regulators are ignorant. It's rather that the owners and managers are unaccountable. Once upon a time, specifically between the National Banking Act of 1863 and the Banking Act of 1935, the impairment or bankruptcy of a nationally chartered bank triggered a capital call, not on the taxpayers, but on the stockholders. It was their bank, after all. Individual accountability in banking was the rule in the advanced economies. Hartley Withers, the editor of The Economist in the early 20th century, shook his head at the micromanagement of American banks by the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. 25% of their deposits had to be kept in cash, i.e. gold, or money lawfully convertible into gold. The rules held. Yet New York had panics. London had none. Adjured Withers. good banking is produced not by good laws, but by good bankers. End of quote. Well-fed withers. And what makes a good banker is more than skill. It is also the fear of God, or more specifically, accountability for the solvency of the institution that he or she owns or manages. To stay out of trouble, general partners of Brown Brothers Harriman, Wall Street's oldest surviving general partnership, need no regulatory pep talk. Each partner is liable for the debts of the firm to the full extent of his or her net worth. My colleague Paul Isaac, who is with me today, he doubles as my food and beverage taster, has an intriguing suggestion for instilling the credit culture more deeply in our semi-socialized banking institutions. We can't turn limited liability corporations into general partnerships, nor could we easily reinstate the so-called double liability law on bank stockholders. But what we could and should do, Paul urges, is to claw back that portion of the compensation paid out by a failed bank in excess of 10 times the average wage in manufacturing for the 7 full calendar years before the ruined bank hit the wall. Such a clawback would not be subject to averaging or offset one year to the next, and it would be payable in cash. The idea, Pauls explains, is twofold. First, to remove the government from the business of determining what is or is not risky. Really, the government doesn't know. Secondly, to increase the personal risk of failure for senior management, but stopping short of the sword of Damocles of unlimited personal liability. If bankers are venal, why not harness that venality in the public interest? For the better part of 100 years, and especially in the past 5, we have socialized the risks of high finance. All too often, the bankers who take risks don't themselves bear them. By all means, let the capitalists keep the upside, but let them bear their full share of the downside. In March 2009, the Financial Times published a letter to the editor concerning the then novel subject of QE. Quote, "I can now understand the term quantitative easing," wrote Gerald B. Hill of Stourbridge, West Midlands, "but realize I can no longer understand the meaning of the word money." End of quote. There isn't time in these brief remarks to persuade you of the necessity of a return to the classic gold standard. I would need another 10 minutes at least. But I anticipate some skepticism. Very well then. Consider this fact. On March the 27th, 1973, not quite 39 years ago, the forerunner to today's G20 solemnly agreed that the special drawing right, also known as SDR, quote, will become the principal reserve asset and the role of gold and reserve currencies will be reduced, end of quote. That was the establishment, i.e. you, talking. If a worldwide accord on the efficacy of the SDR is possible, all things are possible, including a return to the least imperfect international monetary standard that has ever worked. Notice, I do not say the perfect monetary system or best monetary system ever dreamt up by a theoretical economist. The classical gold standard, 1879 to 1914, with all its anomalies and exceptions, worked. The quoted words I draw from a book entitled The Rules of the Game, Reform and Evolution in the International Monetary System by Kenneth W. Dam, a law professor and former provost of the University of Chicago. Dam's was a grudging admiration, a little like that of the New York Fed's own Arthur Bloomfield, whose 1959 monograph, Monetary Policy Under the International Gold Standard, was published by yourselves. No, Bloomfield points out, as does Dam, the classical gold standard was not quite automatic. But it was synchronous. It was self-correcting. And it did deliver both national solvency and, over the long run, uncanny price stability. The banks were solvent too, even the central banks, which, as Bloomfield noted, monetized no government debt. The visible hallmark of the classical gold standard was, of course, gold. So every currency holder was given the option of exchanging metal for paper or paper for metal at a fixed statutory rate. Exchange rates were fixed, and I mean fixed. It is quite remarkable, Dam writes, that from 1879 to 1914, in a period considerably longer than from 1945 to the demise of Bretton Woods in 1971, there were no changes of parities between the United States, Britain, France, Germany, not to speak of a number of smaller European countries. End of quote. The fruits of this fixedness were many and sweet. Among them, again, to quote Dam, quote, a flow of private foreign investment on a scale the world has never seen and, relative to other economic aggregates, was never to see again. End of quote. Incidentally, the source of my purchased copy of Rules of the Game was the library of the Federal Reserve Bank of Atlanta. Apparently, President Lockhart isn't preparing, as I am, as, may I suggest, as you should be, for the coming of classical gold standard part two. By way of preparation, I commend to you a new book by my friend Lou Lehman, The True Gold Standard, A Monetary Reform Plan Without Official Reserve Currencies, How We Get From Here to There. It is a little rich, my extolling gold to an institution that sits on 216 million troy ounces, valued at $42.222 per ounce, the hoard in your basement is worth $9.1 billion. Incidentally, the official price was quoted in SDRs, $35 to the ounce. Now, there's a quixotic choice for you. In 2008, when your in-house publication, The Key to the Gold Vault, was published, the market value was $194 billion. Today, the market value is $359 billion, which is encouraging only if you personally happen to be long gold bullion. Otherwise, it strikes me as a pretty severe condemnation of modern central banking. And what would I do if, following the inauguration of Ron Paul, I was sitting in the chairman's office? I would do what I could to begin the normalization of interest rates. I would invite the Wall Street Journal's John Hilsenhardt to lunch to let him know that the Fed is now well over its deflation phobia and has put aside its Atlas complex. It's capitalism for us, John, I would say. Next, I would call President Dudley. Bill, I would say pleasantly, we're not exactly leading from the front in the regulatory drive to reduce the ratio of assets to equity at the big American financial institutions. Do you have to be leveraged 89-1? Finally, I would redirect the efforts of the brainiacs of the Federal Reserve Board Research Division. Ladies and gentlemen, I would say, enough with Bayesian analysis of stochastic volatility models with Levy jumps, application to risk analysis. How much better it would please me if you wrote to the subject, Command and Control No More, a gold standard for the 21st century. Finally, my pièce de résistance, I would commission staff and ceremonially open the Fed's first office of unintended consequences. Let me thank you once more for the honor that your invitation does me. Concerning little grants and the big Fed, I will quote in parting the opening sentences of an editorial that appeared in a provincial Irish newspaper in the fateful year 1914. It read, "We give this solemn warning to Kaiser Wilhelm. The Skibbereen Eagle has its eye on you." And ladies and gentlemen, with that, we will now take a break, and I'll be right back. you are interested in the Skibbereen Eagle, it was a newspaper in a small, dusty little town in Ireland, which basically predicted the horrors of what was about to happen in Germany and the European world in the late 19th, early 20th century, and grew in importance as a result of this extraordinary and once-off prediction of what was about to happen. So there you have it, ladies and gentlemen, the really quite stunning talk, I thought, by Jim Grant, who is always worth listening to, a very, very fine commentator of all things temporal, money-wise. And I urge you and encourage you to read whatever you can about him and from him, and listen to his clips that he comes up with quite frequently on the mainstream media to give the flip side of what's going on. Well, official data from the U.S. Federal Reserve have laid bare the eye-watering size of trading positions built up by J.P. Morgan's chief investment office in synthetic credit indices, raising further questions about risk management standards at the bank. According to the figures, J.P. Morgan's position in investment-grade credit default swaps jumped eightfold from a net long of $10 billion notional at the end of 2011 to $84 billion at the end of the first quarter this year. The Fed data support previous reports about the nature of the trading strategy that has led to the recent losses that we've heard so much about. In investment-grade CDS with a maturity of 1 year or less, J.P. Morgan's net short position rocketed from $3.6 billion notional at the end of September 2011 to $54 billion at the end of the first quarter of this year. Over the same period, J.P. Morgan's long position in investment-grade CDS with a maturity of more than 5 years leapt five times, from $24 billion to $102 billion. According to one seasoned credit analyst, I don't care how big a bank you are, that's still a big move. And this supports reports from market sources that the CIO positions were duration-neutral curve flatteners intended to benefit from credit markets quickly souring. Never mind what that means, ladies and gentlemen. It simply means it's excuses, excuses, excuses. One of the main strategies is understood to be buying the market CDX North America Investment Grade Index Series 9 maturing in December 2012 and selling protection on the same contract maturing in December 2017. The size of the positions lends credence to credit experts' views that it will take J.P. Morgan a long time to close the position, particularly given the illiquidity of the off-the-run indices that are thought to be involved. It also illustrates that the CIO it will not be able to allow the risk to simply roll off its books due to the substantial portion of it that is long-dated. Well, I know that sounds like gobbledygook to you, and it does to me too, quite frankly, if you really want the truth. But the reality, ladies and gentlemen, is that these people couldn't trade themselves out of a paper bag. There are many more of these crises coming down the pike, and this one, which started out at $2 billion, has already made to $3.5 billion and probably will go to $7.8 billion before this is all over, is just par for the course. And really, what has motivated this bank to go from a tiny level of exposure to these gigantic levels in just a few years can only be ascribed to insanity. I mean insanity in the truest possible sense of the word. There is no reason attached to this. I mean, you can call it greed if you like, and you wouldn't be far wrong either. But the reality is that the entire financial system has gone berserk. We're going to see it in Greece, we'll see it in Spain, and we'll see it in the rest of Europe, and believe me, ladies and gentlemen, it will come in short order to the United States. This is very, very grim. What I just read you from these statistics please don't think that they're just mind-numbing pieces of nonsense to be endured until I get on with some juicy letters, you know, from our listeners or something like that. It is essential for you to know what's going on. Please take note. We are in very, very grim waters indeed, uncharted though they may be. Nobody knows what's going to happen. Nobody has the slightest idea of just how dreadful this is all going to be, but I assure you it is going to be one for the history books, and you can put away all the rest of the history books at the same time. All right, let's take a couple of emails that we have. One is from Alan Elliott in California, who says, "Hello, Richard. You mentioned at the end of your last show, I believe Monday, the 21st of May, that we need to get out of the United States because it's going to be hell on earth." I'm paraphrasing. "What exactly do you mean by that? And what exactly is going to happen after everything breaks down to make it hell, as you put it? Also, what do you think the key event will be that is going to make the deck of cards come down? Is it just hyperinflation and mass unemployment? Or is it worse? Please explain. You may have answered this in other shows, but I'm new to yours for about a month now. Thank you very much. I enjoy your show, as always. Alan Elliott, California." Well, Alan, I think I've already started to explain a little bit about what I meant. Let me, as always, put your mind at rest about this hyperinflation. There will not be hyperinflation, in my opinion. There will be something much worse. Deflation. Trust me on that, ladies and gentlemen. It's hard to cope with hyperinflation, but it is possible. I mean, yes, you can buy gold to protect you from hyperinflation. You can buy houses. You can buy diamonds and other forms of artwork to keep you happy and to keep your money worth something. In deflation, which nobody wants to talk about because it is so grim, you can do nothing. There is no cure for deflation. Prices fall, which is very nice if you have money stashed away either in a bank which will pay you out when it fails or under the mattress. But you can't do anything to protect yourself for it. It will happen with or without you. And if you have a business, it will infect and annihilate your business in all probability. If you have any debts that have to be paid, where the hyperinflation that everybody so charmingly talks about will take care of your debts, thank you very much. Yes, they'll all be paid off in short order as the value of money goes to zero. But in deflation, that is the black specter, the horror that nobody wants to talk about, because that is what is worse than anything, ladies and gentlemen. There is nothing you can do. So that is the answer, Alan. If you have the imagination to conjure up what hell on earth means at that kind of time, I invite you to do so. For the rest of you, ladies and gentlemen, I do not know what it means. There are no textbooks that tells us what happens when businesses seize up, when everything goes to hell in a handbasket, when you simply cannot get the modern conveniences that you've come to enjoy and get used to, and if you can get them, you're not making the money enough with which to pay for them. It's a very, very grim scenario, and deflation will take you there. Hyperinflation will not. And I maintain that that is why people are bullish on gold, because they don't think things are going to be that bad. And therefore, of course, they will sign up for gold, because hyperinflation will take them through courtesy of their gold, and they'll be laughing all the way to the bank and beyond. But in deflation, I'm afraid the price of your gold will fall, because there's no use for gold at high prices when the price of everything else is collapsing. It's sheer logic. So there you have it. Alan, thank you very much for the email. I was glad to have another opportunity to expound on my pet theories. So now I have an email from Brad Hansen, and Brad says, "Richard, I'm sorry, but you are all wet. Keynesianism economics is based on the premise that when a country has an economic slowdown, the government should have the ability to run a deficit in order to prop up the economy until it recovers. It doesn't say anything about printing money to cover a deficit or never paying down the deficit. The fact that after the economy has recovered, a government, instead of paying back the deficit, chooses instead to increase spending has nothing to do with Keynesian economics. To say that this administration or the last is using Keynesian economic theory is hogwash. You're telling me that Robert Rubin and Larry Summers are followers of Keynes, and suggesting that Austrian theory is really the way to go is also rubbish. If you want recent evidence on how well that theory worked out for you, all you have to do is look at the George W. Bush administration, where they cut taxes twice and desired an atmosphere of freedom for entrepreneurs and financial institutions. And where all those fine folks did then was run the economy in the ground, bankrupt the nation, and create the biggest U.S. crisis since the Great Depression. Further evidence of how well that theory plays out is rested in the hands of the IMF and the World Bank, where they demand strict austerity from their borrowers in exchange for huge loans and the control of the local economy, which makes very few people rich, bankrupts the country, and leaves the pickings for multinationals and foreign financiers to steal what's left. A lot of those countries have finally gotten hip to that scheme and also told the institutions to take a hike when they come calling again. The plain truth of the matter is that the US and Europe economies are on the verge of financial collapse because of hedonism. The quickest way to fill my pocketbook is to steal it from your pocket, plain and simple. If you're playing as an honest broker, like Iceland or Ma and Pa with a home that is ripe for great refi ripoff, then you are playing a sucker's hand. This was caused, pure and simple, by greed. And the greediest players do not want to accept any of the pain, so we must all suffer. I bet if you looked at the federal budget from the end of the Korean War until this year, then removed 50% of the defense budget from each year, America would be running a surplus twice the size of our current deficit. Brad Hansen. Well, Brad, thank you very much for that. It was a long email, ladies and gentlemen, and I read it because I wanted you basically to understand that this is pretty classic thinking by one of our dear listeners, as expounded by himself. And I wanted to obviously discuss a couple of the things that the email throws up. I didn't say, I think, anything about printing money to cover a deficit. I didn't say that that was the issue here, of course, I believe that you understand that that is not necessarily a good idea. Robert Rubin, by the way, and Larry Summers, they used to be followers of Keynes. They changed their tune when they saw it didn't work, and they did it actually quite subtly. It was difficult to see where the change came, but they did reject largely the concept of Keynesianism as time went by. And Keynesianism, as you will remember, ladies and gentlemen, is basically deficit spending, as Brad correctly points out. The trouble, Brad, is that when you don't have anything to spend, as Margaret Thatcher would say, socialism ends when you run out of other people's money to spend. Poor Margaret didn't really bargain for QE, did she? She didn't. She lived in a time before QE was the answer to what happens when you don't have any more money available to spend. And unfortunately, that is the element that has taken place to take Keynesian economics to its ultimate level. Although I would agree with you, Brad, he didn't specifically state that you should ruin the country in order to do that, but that's basically what happened. George Bush didn't, by the way, espouse the Austrian theory. The Austrian theory, I think, is a very useful device that keeps discipline in place, Brad. You say it isn't the way to go. I do think that a variation of it is the way to go. You do have to keep tabs on what you're spending. You can't spend what you don't have forever. And that is pretty much what we're looking at in terms of most of the governments of the West that are indebted. they're really looking at just going on and on and on spending. And it's going to be very interesting to see what happens when we get to the fiscal cliff on December 31st, because the fiscal cliff allows for automatic cuts in spending if the jokers in the government haven't made their decisions. Well, the only decisions they've made so far is to reduce future spending, and they call that cuts. I think they're going to have a nasty surprise unless a new government, which will have been voted in November at the time of the elections, decides to repudiate the whole thing. It's going to be very interesting to see what happens there. The plain truth, as you say, Brad, is that the U.S. and Europe economies are on the verge of financial collapse because of hedonism. Absolutely correct. It's greed, as you point out. You make good points here. But the trouble is, it's how you deal with the greed that we're really trying to deal with here. It's not the greed itself. I think that's the problem that we have. And the variation of Keynesianism, which is in use right now, is really not the way to go. You can't put off the inevitable forever. And that's what Germany is on about. Germany is saying, no, 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 no. We are not going to go on spending more money that we don't have. Somebody has to put an end to this. And, you know, with Greece in dire straits, I'm not going to go into what should be done to save Greece at this point, but, the truth is that Greece has continued to spend and will continue to spend, apparently, according to all the signs. If they don't spend in euros because they go back to their local currency, guess what? They'll spend in drachma. But this spending habit has got to stop, and I don't know how to stop it. I'm not a politician. I'm not an economist, and I'm not paid to do that either, but I'm paid to come here, I come here before you, ladies and gentlemen, on Progressive Radio Network at the wake-up call to inform you of what is happening in the way that the mainstream press probably doesn't. So anyway, thank you, Brad. Very useful, interesting letter. I may be a little less wet than I was, but I'm doing the best I can to dry out. All right. We have another email from Anonymous. Dr. Martin, thank you very much for the doctorate that I never took, but I will take it in the spirit in which it's meant. Dr. Martin, I am investigating what areas are best to relocate to during the coming recession. I have emailed before and am a pretty active listener to the program. I am late 20s, work for a large Fortune 500 company with options to transfer, have no debt, working on enough savings to feel comfortable to leave, and live in Atlanta, Georgia. I would prefer to either work for a smaller company or myself in the future. I am traveling to Asia this fall to investigate opportunities over there. Singapore, Hong Kong are among a few of my destinations, and I'm very excited about the trip. My main curiosity is how bad the global financial crisis will affect the Asian markets. Will it be an all right place to weather the storm when the Western economies really start to falter? The other locations I'm looking at are in Latin America. I am an avid listener to Johnny's show, mainly Colombia. If it is easiest to call to discuss to let me know when it is best, or if you would rather address this question over email or your radio program, please let me know, as I imagine I'm not the only listener who has this on his or her mind. Please don't read my name on the air. Thanks, and I look forward to your response. Well, thank you, Anonymous. Let me go right to the nitty-gritty here. I think the financial crisis will affect the Asian markets deeply and very profoundly, yes. The difference, as I've always said, is that because these countries do not owe any money outside their own local economies, they will bounce back very quickly, rather along the lines that America did after the Second World War. It will be the place to weather the storm long before the Western economies really start to falter. Anonymous, you should be on your way already. I don't know why you would be waiting for the fall. You need to gather your money together, sell out whatever assets you may have in the United States quickly, and go to wherever you feel comfortable. I'm getting reports now from people who have moved already to Latin America, and the reports are very, very positive. I can tell you, I'm not making this up. People have moved from the States, they're living in Latin America, and they are feeling good about their move. So I do believe that that is a great place to go. Colombia has the advantage of being very close to the United States. Very educated people. Yes, go to Colombia by all means. And do feel free to call me if you would like to discuss this in more detail. So, good. Let's take another email from Ron, who says, "Hi, Richard. I am sure you read the NAR press release, April existing home sales up, prices rise again, which includes statements like the following. A return to normal home buying. What is normal home buying? In some areas, it has become a seller's market. How do you define what a seller's market is? As you can see, by reading the NAR press release, the recovery is well on its way, and with the improving housing market, the recession will soon be over. After all, the NAR would never lie about the facts, though they might present them in a self-serving way. No. The NARA only deals with facts and presents them in a true and unbiased way. Nos vemos, Ron. Nos vemos being the Spanish for we'll see." Well, ladies and gentlemen, I've never heard so many screams, yelps, cries of victory. Ron is absolutely right. The real estate market has turned round again. Prices are going to soar. Everybody will have a home within the next 10 minutes, and all will be well. The one thing that all these people absolutely fail to point out is that there are mountains and mountains and mountains of unsold inventory on the books of these banks and other organizations who happen to hold housing in their portfolio. So quite frankly, I would be very, very wary of predicting the end of the housing market decline. I think it has a long way to go and a lot of time left in it, ladies and gentlemen. I have seen the charts, the little telltale upward hook indicating the beginning of a recovery, but I'm afraid that is clutching for straws. We are not anywhere close to the end of the housing decline. So don't go out and start buying houses yet. You could perhaps consider, if you absolutely need to buy a house in the lower end of the range of places where the declines have been greatest, with the proviso that you are sure to want to stay there for many years to come. But for the rest, I would say stay away. All right, well, here is an email from Steve Kruger. "Richard, a few weeks back, my computer was acting up, so I thought I would shop for a new one. As a starting point, I received a 100-day, one-day dollar, one-day coupon from Staples. I wanted a Dell 8300 XPS with a 1.5 chip, 1.5 tera hard drive, 8 gigs memory. This unit a few years back was $1,500 from Dell, and today Dell gets $750 for this unit. Moore's Law at work. Also known as deflation, Steve. Thank you. I thought I would get it at Staples and use my coupon. You can research what you want at Staples to see if it's in the store. Save you a trip. The second Staples had the unit. I got to the store Saturday around 1 p.m. The store was empty. About 7 employees were standing around just talking. My Dell 8300 was right on the shelf with a price of $517, so I asked for the explanation. It was the floor model. Richard, he said he put it out 2 days ago. I think this was true as the electric cord was still in the box. We went to the checkout. I gave him my $100 coupon, and I got it for $417 plus tax. Spent 30 minutes in the store. Still nobody walked in. I remember Staples had an office furniture department that they had only a few desk chairs and all the furniture is gone. You can see they have spread out the other stuff to take up the area. I would not be shocked to see a load of Staples closing." Steve Kruger. I wouldn't be shocked either, Steve. Thank you very much for that. Ladies and gentlemen, that is the prime example of deflation at work. I couldn't have said it better myself. Well, we've come to the end of another show. As I say, it was recorded, so anybody who might have called in understand that there was no reply, and I didn't read any emails that might have come up on the screen either, because I shall be enjoying the delights of northern Thailand for the weekend. I will be back next Friday, same place, and I hope you all had a wonderful Memorial Day. Those of you who are listening to the archives, sun yourself nicely on sunny beaches. I will be back. Take care of yourselves. This is Richard Martin saying bye-bye till then.